Our headlines, Ukrainian authorities say the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, catches fire due to an attack by Russian troops. Moscow and Kyiv agree to the need for humanitarian corridors to help civilians escape the nine-day-long war in Ukraine. And stock markets in Europe and the U.S. shed points while oil prices jump to new levels as Russia's attack against Ukraine rocks the global economy. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Ukrainian officials say the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in southeastern Ukraine, the largest of its kind in Europe, is now on fire after an attack by Russian troops. Officials say the fire started of shelling of an area close to the facility. A generating unit at the plant has reportedly caught on fire. Ukraine's foreign minister calls for a security zone and firefighters to be allowed to tackle the blaze. Dmytro Kuleba warned that an explosion at the site will be 10 times larger than the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear meltdown. The UN Nuclear Agency has also called for a halt to attacks around the site. The Associated Press has quoted a government official as saying that elevated levels of radiation are detected near the plant. Another report, however, says radiation level is unchanged. Joining me now to discuss that story further is Frank Emspach. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin, joining us from Madison. Professor Emspach, thank you so much. So what do you think about the possible explosion at the nuclear plant? The power plant is said to be, if an explosion occurs, it's going to be 10 times larger and more devastating compared to what happened in Chernobyl. How do you think this will affect the conflict?
I just can't imagine. The whole thing is unimaginable. This is extraordinarily dangerous. I think that that to fool around with this kind of nuclear energy, to endanger a power plant, is absolutely crazy. And I say this not being totally ignorant. One of my duties at the School for Workers when I was here was there before I retired was to visit power plants in the nuclear power plants in the area here in the Midwest to work with the union and the company on safety mechanisms and how to make sure things worked. And the whole big thing with a nuclear power plant, of course, is the cooling system, the water to cool the reactors and to cool the spent fuel. And if that is disrupted, that's when you have absolute disaster, which is what happened at Chernobyl. So any kind of disturbance of this nature is just really just insane, really. I guess the best you could say. And clearly, if something is breached, if one of these power plants, there's more than one, I think there are 16 of them in the Ukraine, if one of them begins to melt down or do what happened with Chernobyl, we have a disaster of unmitigated proportion. It's just the wrong thing to do. And I think anybody, almost everybody, has recognized that the right thing to do here is to cease fire and enter into some kind of discussion. I think most of the people who've commented on this, no matter where they're at in terms of the Russians' issues, realize that that what has to happen here is a ceasefire and a probably a withdrawal of Russian troops. And certainly not to be fighting around nuclear power plants where if anything goes wrong, it's devastating not only for the neighborhood, but for wide swaths of the continent.
Right. But let's look at it from Russia's perspective. Now, they want to demilitarize Ukraine, and they had already stated to take control of that power plant. I don't think that Russia here, I want to actually get your opinion on this, but I don't think the Russians are actually looking for an explosion at a power plant, a nuclear power plant that large, the largest of its kind in Europe. But it's quite in line with their, you know, the overall agenda to denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. Don't you think so?
Sure, but I think that Ukrainians have a different point of view. And, you know, I think that to, again, fight or launch an attack around a power plant, if that's what's happening, of course, we can't tell based on the news reports. You know, there's all kinds of things that can happen in a place like this, including, you know, the errant shell, a mistake, all kinds of stuff. But I think that the best thing to do here in terms of protecting everybody would be to reach an agreement. They're negotiating immediately that these power plants are going to be off limits because something can go wrong. It's so easy under the best of circumstances. And I think the consequences are disastrous for both the Russians and the Ukrainians. But what happens if you have a situation like a Chernobyl? It wasn't just Ukraine that was affected.
True. One last question for you. What are the chances of this military conflict spreading beyond the borders of Ukraine if an explosion at that magnitude happens?
Well, I have no idea. It sort of depends what happens. And I think that if something like that does happen, that will ramp up the anxiety throughout Europe. Definitely people will begin to say, maybe we should intervene and stop this. And I think that this is an extraordinarily dangerous and fraught situation. I just think that at this point, that the best possible outcome would be a ceasefire and negotiations to resolve the issues, if possible, and to resolve them if possible. But definitely to stop fighting around these plants, because there are more than one. Anything can go wrong, and if something does, it's irreversible. Mm-hmm. It's not that you can just put out the fire if there's a radiation release. It's beyond that.
Professor, thank you for joining us. I've been talking to Frank Emspach, a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin, joining us from Madison. Moving on, Russia says its military operation in Ukraine is going according to plans and that nothing will stop Moscow from achieving its objectives. President Vladimir Putin made the remarks in a phone call with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron. Putin said Moscow wants to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine in order to make sure that Kiev will not pose a threat to Russia. Putin warned Ukraine against dragging out negotiations, saying that the Kremlin's demands will only increase if the talks are stalled. The president dismissed reports of Russia bombing of civilian targets as disinformation. Earlier, Russia's top diplomat said some foreign leaders are preparing for war against Russia.
We won't let some provocations make us lose our balance. But those who plan to start a full-scale war against us should think. And I think that these plans are being plotted now.
Sergei Lavrov says Western politicians, unlike Russia, are contemplating the prospect of nuclear war. The top Russian diplomat accused NATO of seeking to maintain supremacy over his country. He urged the West to show Moscow mutual respect, emphasizing that Russia will not let anyone undermine its interests. On Ukraine, Lavrov stressed that Russia will not tolerate a military threat. He said his country will not allow Ukraine to keep infrastructure that endangers the security of Russians and that the ongoing military operation is aimed at stopping Kyiv from joining NATO. The Russian foreign minister also accused Ukraine's president of ruling in an atmosphere where Nazism is flourishing. Now let's take a look at a map that shows how Russian forces have been advancing in Ukraine over the past week. As mentioned earlier, Moscow has seized the Black Sea port of Kherson in the south. The city's mayor says Russian troops will next likely head west toward Mykolaiv, where Ukrainian forces have retreated to before making their way to Odessa. And to the east of Kherson, Russian forces are trying to take over the port city of Mariupol, since it will merge Moscow's advances with the pro-independence forces in the Donbass region. Conflict is also heating up in Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv. Russia also keeps progressing towards the capital, Kyiv. It has so far taken control of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in northern Ukraine and is also laying siege to the country's biggest atomic plant in southeastern city of Zaporizhia. Russia and Ukraine conclude the second round of direct talks held at the Poland-Belarus border with the aim of reaching a ceasefire. Both sides say they have an understanding regarding the creation of humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians. According to Ukrainian negotiator Mykhailo Podolyak, the delegations also weighed in on the possibility of temporary ceasefires to allow for those evacuations. That will be only in areas where the humanitarian corridors will be opened. Podolyak says the negotiations didn't yield the results Kyiv had hoped for. He says the two sides have agreed to hold a third round of talks early next week. A Russian negotiator has meanwhile reported substantial progress in the negotiations. Global markets are feeling the pinch of Russia's military operation in Ukraine, with U.S. and European stocks sliding and oil prices surging to record levels. The tech-rich Nasdaq Composite Index tumbled 1.6%, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the broad-based S&P 500 dropped 0.3% and 0.5%, respectively. The losses were greater in Europe, as Paris, Frankfurt, and London stocks all shed at least 1.8%. Brent crude also reached nearly $120 a barrel, the highest in about a decade. Gas prices are rising as well. Observers warn that consumers have to bear the brunt if energy prices continue to rise. The high comes amid fears of supply disruptions due to the ongoing Russian-Ukraine military conflict. The EU adopts an emergency measure to provide protection to millions of refugees fleeing the war in Ukraine. It follows years of criticism over the bloc's treatment of refugees arriving from conflict zones involving Western military intervention. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
A huge number of Ukrainian refugees continue to arrive at EU borders in Poland, Slovakia, Romania and Hungary. On Thursday, EU Home Affairs ministers adopted the Temporary Protection Directive. It means the refugees can work and go to school in any of the bloc's 27 member states for at least 1 year.
If you compare to the refugees that came in 2015, how long time it took to have the proper decisions. For example, just to have their asylum applications processed, it could take years.
So, by the EU's own admission, refugees travelling here from conflict zones involving Western military powers did not and do not receive the same protection. Meanwhile, advocates are calling on the EU to pay particular attention to certain groups.
In general, people who are displaced in a forced way are vulnerable. But we want to call attention to specifically the situation of women and girls because they are disproportionately affected.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen travelled to Slovakia and Romania on Thursday to assess the refugee crises facing the two EU nations. She took the opportunity to try and apply additional pressure on Moscow.
The three waves of sanctions we introduced are already having an impact on the Russian economy and therefore Putin's war effort. And we will take additional steps if the situation deteriorates on the ground.
Non-EU country Moldova has taken in more than 100,000 Ukrainian refugees so far. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell visited the country on Thursday to offer support. However, there is concern over the treatment of some who are trying to reach the EU from Ukraine. Senior UN officials are criticising evidence of discrimination by EU border authorities against African and Asian nationals attempting to flee the conflict. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
Iran's foreign ministry says it is premature to say an agreement on reviving the JCPOA has been made. In a tweet, the ministry's spokesman said nobody can say the deal is cut until all the outstanding issues are resolved. Said Khatibzadeh noted that everybody is now focused on the final critical steps to reach a deal. He, however, said extra efforts are needed so that such an agreement can be made. Iran says Washington needs to make a political decision to meet Tehran's remaining demands. This includes guarantees that the United States will not quit the pact again and that its anti-Iran sanctions are removed in a verifiable manner. Iran says it will not provide relevant information from IAEA cameras installed at its Isfahan facility until the 2015 agreement is revived. Acting head of Iran's permanent mission to the Vienna-based international organizations, Mohammad Reza Ghoebi announced the decision, saying it's aimed at protecting the rights of the Iranian people. This follows a report by the head of International Atomic Energy Agency about verifying the implementation of the JCPOA in Iran. The report says there has been an agreement to install surveillance cameras at the Karaj facility, but the IAEA's new inspection devices will be installed in the Isfahan facility since Iran decided to relocate its workshop for manufacturing centrifuge rotor tubes to the central city. Our Vienna correspondent, Homa Lizgi, gives us more details about Tehran's decision to ban transferring data of IAEA surveillance cameras at Iran nuclear facilities. Let's take a listen.
How the Iranian mission here in Vienna has responded to this report. Initial response that we're getting, of course, is that Mr. Ra'evi, who is currently at the head of the Iranian mission, says that, as you just mentioned there, this report by Mr. Grossi mentions the fact that as of the 24th of January of this year, after Iran announced to the agency that it is now transferring its workshop from Karaj, which came under a sabotage attack, to a new location in Isfahan, now on the 24th of January, the new IAEA cameras that were initially given to Iran for analysis were then installed in that location. However, the data that's being recorded by these cameras and also cameras elsewhere will not be given to the agency. They will be kept in seal in Iran until there is, of course, an agreement on reviving the JCPOA, because, of course, we know that the Iranian parliament passed a law based on which IAEA access was restricted as of we're hearing the 23rd of February, based on this IAEA report of 2021. The access was restricted. However, in order for the agency to have the continuity of knowledge, if the JCPOA is revived, the agency was allowed to record the information via its cameras, but not have access to that information.
Iran's Minister of Industry, Mine and Trade is on a state visit to Armenia. The visit by Reza Fatemi Amin comes at Yerevan's invitation and is in line with Tehran's policy of expanding ties with its neighbors. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Many thanks for your company. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new statistical report on the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza shows the unbearable price paid by Palestinians for the maintenance of a Jewish state in Palestine. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Maureen Claire Morphy Ryder. This article is published under the heading Gaza Pays the Price for Jewish State in Palestine. This is the second part of this article. But so long as Palestinians rightly refuse to submit to the removal and replacement with foreign settlers, the Zionist regime as the colonizing power requires a horrendously violent policy like the Zahir Doctrine. That was admitted by the Haifa University demographer Aaron Sofer, a close advisor to the late Israeli regime Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, ahead of the latter's unilateral withdrawal of settlers from Gaza in 2005 and tightened blockade on the territory 2 years later. Sofer anticipated that Palestinians in Gaza, isolated and closed off and with little other means of leveraging pressure on the Zionist regime, would rely on firing projectiles to resist what has become a medieval siege. We will tell the Palestinians that if a single missile is fired over the fence, we will fire 10 in response, and women and children will be killed, and houses will be destroyed, Sofer explained. Anticipating the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, Sofer added, the pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So, if we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill, all day, every day. This violence is necessary to guarantee a Jewish Zionist regime with an overwhelming majority of Jews, as Sofer thought. That is the logic underlining the Zionist regime's violence last May, when War Minister Benny Gantz warned that no person, area, or neighborhood in Gaza is immune. And so, 14 families lost three or more members when the Zionist regime bombed their homes. Half of all fatalities during the May war occurred in Gaza City, where the Zionist regime targeted densely populated neighborhoods and wiped out multiple generations of individual families. In addition to those killed, nearly 2,000 people in Gaza were wounded, among them 941 men, 630 children, and 397 women. Meanwhile, more than 1,300 residential units were destroyed, and 6,367 sustained significant damage, mainly in northern Gaza and in the Gaza City area. Some 420 hectares of agricultural land was damaged by the Zionist regime's missiles and artillery shells, or because of obstruction to access affecting more than 5,350 people. Additionally, more than 220 livestock and poultry farms were damaged, as were 24 water wells, 169 vehicles, 59 manufacturing plants, 483 commercial facilities, and 871 other facilities, including banks, daycare centers, private offices, schools, houses of worship, and government offices. The rights groups that authored the statistical report point to the Zionist regime's broader policy of harm adopted at the highest levels. In particular, the widespread targeting of family homes in Gaza has appeared as a key feature of the Zionist regime's military attacks, they add. This conduct forms part of the Zionist regime's institutionalized system of racial discrimination and intent to dominate and oppress the Palestinian people as a whole, a policy that amounts to the crime of apartheid. Amnesty International recently joined the Palestinian human rights groups calling on the International Criminal Court to investigate the commission of the crime of apartheid. In Gaza, the Zionist regime subjects Palestinians to a blanket ban on movement as part of its intent to separate and divide Palestinians and thereby to assert its domination over them in furtherance of its overarching settler colonialist agenda, according to Al-Mizan. The tightened blockade since 2007, along with repeated Zionist regime's military assaults, have forced Gaza into profound levels of poverty, aid dependency, food insecurity, and unemployment, and led to the collapse of essential public services, including healthcare and water, sanitation and hygiene, Al-Mizan adds. Indeed, according to the human rights group, the Zionist regime's actions have rendered Gaza all but uninhabitable. The Zionist regime has killed more than 5,200 Palestinians, including some 1,200 children, during four full-scale military offensives in Gaza since 2008. The worsening water crisis in the territory is meanwhile tied to the Zionist regime's demographic engineering in Palestine. As Al-Miza notes, Gaza is one of the most densely populated areas in the world, with two-thirds of its people, refugees, denied the right to return to their lands on the other side of the Gaza-occupied territory's boundary fence. The Zionist regime's targeting of Palestinian homes in Gaza, killing their inhabitants, creates a coercive environment in which families have no choice but to move, Al-Miza adds. This has caused the forced internal displacement of tens of thousands of Palestinian families, a number of whom remain without safe, adequate, and/or affordable permanent housing today. The Zionist regime officials have admitted that the regime is encouraging emigration from Gaza. Facing some of the highest unemployment rates in the world and few prospects, young people with the means of leaving Gaza are doing so. Al-Mizan observes, the aim has been to create and maintain an Israeli-Jewish superiority, consolidating effective control and dominance with the aim of gradually eradicating the indigenous Palestinian people. One missile, one bullet, and one destroyed future at a time.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and on the threshold of the blessed month of Sha'ban, how about reflecting upon a maxim bequeathed to us for our guidance by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Beware of the flight of blessings, for nothing that runs away is returned.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim عليه السلام. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam Musa al-Kadhim was the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim was the son of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, when we talk about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we see historically that he left an amazing legacy full of goodness, righteousness, beauty, and he was a brilliant guide for the community in general. And among the unique aspects that marked Imam al-Kadhim's personality is his steadfastness and determination, his perseverance in front of the difficult events and the ordeals showered upon him by his contemporary tyrants. Old and young have an amazing opportunity to learn to how to deal with life's difficulties by looking into the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: وفضل الفقيه على العابد كفضل الشمس على الكواكب، ومن لم يتفقه في دينه لم يرضى الله له عملا.
إمام موسى الكاظم عليه السلام stated: The superiority of a learned person over a worshipper is as the superiority of the sun over the planets, and whoever does not educate themselves in their religion, Allah will not accept a single deed from them.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about these beautiful conversations and these golden dialogues, if you will, about Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. This divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he taught us so many beautiful things via these conversations with his family members and his companions, his relatives, and the people around him. Of course, we see that the infallible imams, they spoke with people. Even the Messenger of Allah spoke with the people. The messages and the statements that they had weren't monologues. For the most part, they were dialogues. In one such instance, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he advised his companions to do good to their neighbors. And it's interesting, but he also told them regarding their neighbors to be patient towards bearing harm towards such a neighbor. And so Imam al-Kadhim said to his companions in this conversation that a good neighbor is not one who refrains from doing harm, but a good neighbor is one who shows patience towards the harm that is shown to them. Now, if we talk about the first part just a little bit, a good neighbor is not one who refrains from doing harm. Now, of course, that is because a good neighbor should not be doing any kind of harm to their neighbor. And on the other hand, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says that a good neighbor is one who shows patience towards some kind of, you know, minuscule harm or unwanted harm that is coming via their neighbor. Now, showing patience towards harm, I mean, harm here is not like if your neighbor is about to shoot you, just stand there and be patient. No, that's a different situation. Here is being talked about, so sometimes, you know, the neighbor's kid might be throwing a ball at a wall and you can hear it.
Or sometimes maybe the neighbor's kids' toys are on your lawn. These kind of small things, things that one should not be incredibly frustrated or angry about, and things that one shouldn't make a big commotion and a fight about these kind of things, you know? Of course, it goes both ways. Neighbors should respect one another. Neighbors should love one another. Neighbors should protect each other and be careful of the rights of one another. It is related that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said that the Holy Prophet was putting forth statements in his will and testament about neighbors that we thought that they were going to receive inheritance, like they are part of the family. So the rights of a neighbor and the rights of being a good neighbor in this dialogue by Imam Al-Qadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Imam Musa ibn Ja'far one day was approached by a servant who was carrying a bowl of hot water. You've all heard this story before. Look at those who are trained in the school of Ali Muhammad, within the family of Ali Muhammad. She drops this hot bowl of water onto the Imam. Now picture yourself, put yourself in the position of this lady. And the Imam, and what would you do? What would you say? How would you reciprocate what had happened? This lady would know how to speak to the grandson of Rasulullah. She would speak to him using the Quran. She would say to him, what? والكاظمين الغيظ, those who swallow the anger. Imam would say, لقد كظمت غيظي, don't worry, I've swallowed my anger. She says to him, والعافين عن الناس, those who forgive the people. Imam alayhi salam says, لقد عفوت عنك, I have forgiven you, don't worry. She concludes the verse by saying, والله يحب المحسنين, Allah loves the good doers. Imam says to her, اذهبي فأنت حر في سبيل الله. Go, you are free in the way of Allah. Not only did he swallow his anger, not only did he forgive her, but he also reciprocated the bad with good. That is indeed what the religion of Islam has come forward to perfect the moral standards of human beings. And that's why Imam alayhi salam emerged with this type of characteristics and these types of virtues. How wonderful it is that when we commemorate the shahada of the seventh holy Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, we begin to re-examine ourselves and our conduct with the other human beings, not necessarily Muslims. How do we deal with them? In which way do we interact with those who may not necessarily give us what we deserve to be given?
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
say that he does have ties to Muslim extremists. I don't know.
U.S. President Joe Biden delivered a speech in defense of withdrawing American troops from Afghanistan.
To those asking for a third decade of war in Afghanistan, I ask, what is the vital national interest? In my view, we only have one: to make sure Afghanistan can never be used again to launch an attack on our homeland.
The withdrawal was chaotic, but the president had taken his bold decision and stance. Now, more than 1 year into Biden's presidency, this boldness looks like a temporary aberration in U.S. foreign policy. The White House has followed a foreign policy that is unclear on core issues. This chaotic approach has shown itself most vividly in the Biden administration's effort to revive the Iran nuclear deal, known also as the JCPOA.
It's not time to give up. There is some progress being made. The P5 plus one is on the same page, but it remains to be seen.
In his presidential campaign in 2020, Biden left little doubt concerning the deal. In an op-ed for CNN, he wrote, "If Iran returns to strict compliance with the nuclear deal, the United States would rejoin the agreement as a starting point for follow-on negotiations." But in practice, Biden has shown indecisiveness so far. For months, the U.S. president and his team debated whether to enter the JCPOA or to seek a new agreement. After the administration decided to re-enter, it began an after-you game with Iran, laying out a set of conditions and asking Tehran to make the first move, which Tehran rejected outright.
I have to tell you, recent moves, recent rhetoric, don't give us a lot of cause for optimism. Even though the hour is getting very late, it is not too late for Iran to reverse course and engage meaningfully in an effort to return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA.
The Iranians say since the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal, it ought to take the first move, meaning to lift sanctions and to unfreeze Iran's financial assets. Moreover, given Biden's predecessor's unpredictability, the Iranians want the White House to guarantee that it won't repeat what Trump did in 2018 when he pulled out of the deal. That said, when it comes to nuclear agreements, the Americans never follow through on their word. For example, in 1994, the U.S. signed the framework agreement with North Korea to end its nuclear program, but the U.S. never lived up to its obligations under the deal, which included the construction of a light water nuclear reactor and normalizing diplomatic relations, and Pyongyang walked away. Or in the case of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi voluntarily gave up his nuclear program, but that didn't stop the U.S. from actively supporting forces who toppled his government and brutally killed him.
Of course, the big news this week, Gaddafi's dead, rebel forces, killed by rebel forces. Your reaction, your take on this?
Well, this is somebody who for 40 years had terrorized his country, had supported terrorism, and he had an opportunity during the Arab Spring to finally let loose of his grip on power and to peacefully transition to democracy. We gave him ample opportunity, and he wouldn't do it.
Trump's withdrawal from the Iran deal is just the latest case. Against such a backdrop, demanding even more concessions from Tehran does not seem to be the wisest move to revive the deal.
We are very clear-eyed about the hurdles that remain. These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA.
Since most of the sanctions on Iran are based on executive action, there is nothing stopping Biden from going back into the deal. But it seems that Biden is unwilling to upset Iran hawks on Capitol Hill, in particular Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, who is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Since Menendez is a vocal critic of the Iran nuclear deal, Biden is reportedly afraid of provoking him because he would block or slow roll the administration's foreign policy nominees. As Matt Duss, foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, put it, they don't hate the deal because it's a bad deal. They hate the deal because it's a deal with Iran. Full stop. On the JCPOA, there is no consensus to be built with the anti-Iran hawks. The enmity towards Iran is partly due to pressure from powerful interest groups, including the pro-Israel lobby. As Bill Clinton's Middle East envoy Kenneth Pollack once said, from a political standpoint, nobody pays a price to be tough on Iran.
And this is the same spirit that, you know, I want to bring to our relationship of cooperation, of goodwill, of friendship. We're going to be talking about a bunch of issues, primarily how do we fend off and curtail Iran's pursuit to dominate the region.
Israel's security is and always will be unshakable. And we look forward to addressing all of these challenges that we face, particularly regional security and the deep concerns that we share about Iran and the role that it's playing in the region, including its nuclear program.
It's very unlikely that Biden will be able or at least willing to defy this lobby. When Barack Obama came into office, he tried to ease mistrust between Tehran and Washington through a series of peacemaking gestures, such as addressing the Iranians on their new year or writing letters to the leaders of Iran.
So in this season of new beginnings, I would like to speak clearly to Iran's leaders. We have serious differences that have grown over time. My administration is now committed to diplomacy that addresses the full range of issues before us and to pursuing constructive ties among the United States, Iran, and the international community.
But he finally gave in to pressure from then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and as a result adopted anti-Iran policies by imposing sanctions on the country. It was just late in his presidency when he decided to reach an agreement with Iran. Biden, who was Obama's vice president, is now confronted with a similar anti-Iran scenario. Recently, about 200 House Republicans wrote to Biden warning any nuclear deal made with Iran without Congress approval will meet the same fate as the 2015 agreement by Obama, which was later abandoned by Trump. On the other hand, Biden's plunging approval rating has made the administration more timid in its approach to international affairs. Biden is afraid of the backlash from appearing to make concessions to the Islamic Republic. In the words of Jeffrey Lewis of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, Biden is a wimp. He would have taken a political hit for taking a chance on the Iranians that might or might not have worked out, but it would have put the ball in Iran's court. Trump is gone, but his Iran policy is still in place. If the Biden administration wants to be more than a historical footnote on U.S. foreign policy, it needs to be more decisive. It needs to take action on decisions it has adopted rhetorically. The clock is ticking.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Three former Minneapolis police officers were found guilty on Thursday, 24th of February, of federal crimes for failing to intervene as another police officer killed George Floyd by pressing his knee on his neck for more than 9 minutes. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Tim Arango, Nicholas Bogle Burrows, and Jay Center. The piece is titled, Three Former Officers Are Convicted of Violating George Floyd's Civil Rights. Three former Minneapolis police officers were found guilty on Thursday, 24th of February, of federal crimes for failing to intervene as another police officer killed George Floyd by pressing his knee on his neck for more than 9 minutes. The case was an extraordinarily rare example of the Justice Department prosecuting police officers for their inaction while another officer used excessive force. The verdict signaled to police departments across America that juries may become more willing to convict not just police officers who kill people on the job, but also those who watch them do it. A federal jury determined that the police officers, Tu Thao, a 36-year-old, Alexander Kueng, a 28-year-old, and Thomas Lane, a 38-year-old, had willfully violated George Floyd's constitutional rights by not providing medical care when he lost a pulse, and that two of them were also guilty of not intervening to stop a fellow police officer, Derek Chauvin, from planting his knee on George Floyd's neck. Mr. Kueng and Mr. Lane both helped Derek Chauvin restrain George Floyd while he was handcuffed face down on the pavement. Mr. Thao stood nearby, keeping bystanders away. Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder last year and sentenced to 22.5 years imprisonment. The verdicts represented a significant victory for the Justice Department, which under the Biden administration has pledged to be more aggressive in prosecuting civil rights violations. It came just days after federal prosecutors secured hate crimes convictions against three white men in Georgia for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, a black man who they chased and killed. Judge Paul Magnuson said he would allow the three men to remain free on bond until their sentencing hearing, which has not yet been scheduled. Mr. Lane and his lawyer shook their heads as the judge read the guilty verdicts. The other two defendants had no visible reaction. All three men and their lawyers were escorted from the courtroom by a U.S. Marshal. Judge Paul Magnuson has wide latitude to impose penalty and could sentence the three police officers to any amount of prison time, including life imprisonment. They still face state charges of aiding and abetting murder, with a trial scheduled for this year. Federal prosecutors had charged Derek Chauvin along with the other three officers, but he reached a plea agreement with the Justice Department in December, under which prosecutors said they would seek a 25-year prison sentence. George Floyd's relatives hailed Thursday's verdict. "I'm starting to feel like I can breathe again," said Philanese Floyd, a brother of George Floyd. He and Brandon Williams, George Floyd's nephew, said in the courthouse after the verdict that they hoped Judge Paul Magnuson would sentence all three former police officers to the maximum possible prison term. Legal experts and racial justice activists had been closely watching the case, saying it could have more ramifications for policing than even Derek Chauvin's murder convictions. At the heart of this case was a more widespread problem, experts say, than a single officer's act of violence. The tendency of police officers to stand by when they witness a fellow police officer committing a crime. The jurors' decision, which came after about 13 hours of deliberations following a month-long trial, suggested that they agreed with the prosecution's arguments that the police officers knew in the moment that Mr. Floyd was in severe medical distress and that Derek Chauvin was breaking the law. The verdict was also a rejection of the arguments cited in each of the three defense cases, that the police officers trusted Derek Chauvin, the senior police officer on the scene, and therefore were not aware that what he was doing was illegal. This case is believed to be the first time police officers have gone on trial for federal charges of failing to intervene against a more senior police officer who was using excessive force, according to Chrissy Lopez, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. Chrissy Lopez has worked with police departments on training officers about their constitutional duties to step in when they see colleagues breaking the law. She said the guilty verdicts could significantly change law enforcement culture, compelling agencies to make sure that police officers are properly trained and are upholding their duties. "It forces you to move beyond the bad apple narrative," Ms. Lopez said. She added, "Now you're like, oh, everyone on the scene played a role in this. It shifts the entire narrative from misconduct being about just acts of commission to misconduct also being about acts of omission." Meanwhile, Attorney General Merrick Garland said the verdict showed that the police officers had violated the Constitution by not intervening. The Justice Department will continue to seek accountability for law enforcement officers whose actions or failure to act violate their constitutional duty to protect the civil rights of our citizens, Merrick Garland said in a statement. George Floyd should be alive today. During the trial, the defense lawyers tried to absolve the three officers, with Robert Paul, who represented Mr. Thowell, telling the jury during his closing statement that just because something has a tragic ending does not mean it's a crime. As George Floyd was being killed, Mr. Thowell, a veteran officer who was Derek Chauvin's partner, was keeping a crowd of bystanders at bay. Mr. Lane and Mr. Kuang, both rookies, were helping Derek Chauvin detain George Floyd after a convenience store clerk said he had used a fake $20 bill to buy cigarettes. All three police officers, who along with Derek Chauvin were fired just a day after the killing, were charged with one count of failing to provide medical aid. Mr. Kuang and Mr. Thowell were also charged with failing to intervene and stop Derek Chauvin's use of excessive force. Mr. Lane, who twice asked Mr. Chauvin if they should roll George Floyd on his side so he could more easily breathe, did not face that charge. The 12 jurors who decided the case were drawn from across Minnesota because the trial was over federal crimes and all 12 appeared to be white. That was in contrast to the more racially diverse juries drawn from the Minneapolis area that convicted Derek Chauvin and Kimberly Potter, the white police officer in a Minneapolis suburb who shot and killed a black man after mistakenly drawing her gun instead of her taser during a traffic stop. During this trial, prosecutors called to the witness stand doctors, police officers, bystanders, and a paramedic who arrived on the scene and said he believed that George Floyd was already dead. Prosecutors relied on the mountains of video evidence from bystanders, from the officers' body-worn cameras, from city surveillance cameras that provided an excruciating second-by-second record of the killing. One of the most important witnesses during the trial was Inspector Katie Blackwell, a Minneapolis police official who formerly was in charge of training. She testified for 3 days about the training that recruits receive on properly using force –